Jayarada Madhava Kundabihari Jayarada Madhava Kundabihari Gopi Jana Vallabha Giriparadari Gopi Jana Vallabha Giriparadari Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tiravana Chari Yamuna Tiravana Chari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Gopi Jana Vallabha Giriparadari Gopi Jana Vallabha Giriparadari Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tiravana Chari Yamuna Tiravana Chari Jayam Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parvraj Kacharya Sitar Siddhishri Srimadis Devangra Sesi Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai Iskan Chandra Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Nanti Kuti Vaishna Vrinda Ki Jai Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai Prem Shri Gaur Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudeva Gaur Bhaktivedanta Ki Jai Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gogopina Shai Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai Ganga Maya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai Gaur Premanande All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nityanamani. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nivasesa Sinivani Paskatyade Siddharne Andeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavam Shri Rupam Sagra Jatam Sagana Raghunatam Vidam Stam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvaditam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shah Vanchakalpa Chibhishtha Deepa Sindhavya Vatapati Tanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
March 5th, 2018, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii. Meeting from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 29, Explanation of Devotional Service by Lord Kapila, Text 19. Madharmano gunar etai
Madharmano gunar etai
Parisam shuda ashayaha
Purushasyanjasa
Yeti
Shrutamatra Gunam Himam
Shrutamatra Gunam Himam
Mat Dharmanaha of my devotee Gunai with the attributes Etahai these Parisam Shudaha completely purified Ashayaha consciousness Purushasya of a person Anjasa instantly Abhyeti approaches Shruta by hearing Matra simply Gunam quality He certainly Mam me Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. When one is fully qualified with all these transcendental attributes and his consciousness is thus completely purified, he is immediately attracted simply by hearing my name or hearing of my transcendental quality. Purport. In the beginning of this instruction, the Lord explained to his mother that Mad Guna Shruti Mat Trena, simply by hearing of the name, quality, form, etc. of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one is immediately attracted. A person becomes fully qualified with all transcendental qualities by following the rules and regulations as recommended in different scriptures. We have developed certain unnecessary qualities by material association, and by following the above process, we become free from that contamination. To develop transcendental qualities, as explained in the previous verse, one must become free from these contaminated qualities. Madharmano gunara etaya parisam shuddha ashayaha purushasyanjas abhyeti shrutamata gunahimam. And one is fully qualified with all these transcendental attributes and his consciousness is thus completely purified. He is immediately attracted simply by hearing my name or hearing of my transcendental quality. So Prabhupada says here in this purport, we have developed certain unnecessary qualities by material association, and by following the above process, we become free from that contamination. Develop transcendental qualities, as explained in the previous verse, one must become free from these contaminated qualities. So, in general in the world, human beings try to better themselves, at least according to their idea of what is better. I mean, even criminals try to become better criminals. We try to become a better version of ourselves, self-improvement. Everyone has some ideals that they try to live up to. And some people are constantly focusing on what they do right, and some people are focusing on what they do wrong. But whether we focus on what we do right or what we do wrong, our idea is to better ourselves. Our idea is to be the particular ideal that we have in our mind. Now, for most conditioned souls, their ideal is shaped by their material identity. So if someone says, well, I'm the husband, then they're thinking the ideal for me looks like whatever an ideal husband is in my mind. You know, if I'm a citizen of France, then I think, what would an ideal citizen of France behave like? So our sense of ideal is not overall and generic, but it's in relation to our particular identity. I want to be a good son. I want to be a good employee of, you know, Alcoa Aluminum, whatever, according to our particular identity. And, of course, we're encouraged in creating a particular ideal according to our material identity by the society in which we live, by our parents, our family in general, our school system, our country, our employers, and so forth. They encourage us, you are this, you are a son, you are a daughter, you are a husband, you are a wife, you are a renunciate, you are, you know. And we form our ideals in that way. At the same time, there's also certain generic ideals for human beings to which we aspire. And there was a study done quite some time ago as to whether or not there were any universal, non-culturally influenced ideals. And the study came up with five, and that is purity, respect for authority, fairness, community or loyalty, and not doing any harm. Now, of course, how those are interpreted varies from culture and culture, and how they're weighted, one could say, whether there's more emphasis on community or more emphasis on authority depends on the particular culture. But those five basic principles of an ideal human were ones that were transcultural. So we have some ideas. You know, an ideal human doesn't do unnecessary harm. An ideal human is fair. An ideal human has respect for authority. An ideal human does things that are healthy and pure. An ideal human is loyal to their community. But we always find, I believe I can say everybody finds that they fall short. They fall short in terms of the general human qualities, and they fall short in terms of their particular identity and their ideal. Then beyond those, according to our identity and generic qualities, we have these qualities of a saintly person, which Lord Kapiladev has been giving here in this chapter. We know Lord Kapiladev gives the 26 qualities of a devotee. In the previous verses, he's saying devotee should always try to hear about spiritual matters, should always utilize his time in chanting the holy name of the Lord. Behavior should be straightforward and simple. And although he is not envious but friendly to everyone, he should avoid the company of persons who are not spiritually advanced. I mean, that's a pretty high bar, I think, for most of us. Execute devotional service by giving the greatest respect to the spiritual master and acharyas, compassionate to the poor, make friendship with persons who are equals. All activities should be executed under regulation with control of the senses. So these are higher ideals than what's in society in general for human beings. And if we're struggling even to achieve the regular human rajagun qualities, then how much more are we going to struggle to achieve sattvagun qualities or transcendental qualities? And it may seem like it's a never-ending uphill battle. And I think to some extent, as we progress in spiritual life, we become more and more honest and more aware of how we fall short in this regard, to the point that the great devotees will say, you know, I'm lower than the worm in stool, and I'm more fallen than Jagai and Madai, and so forth. Whoever hears my name will be sinful. So the devotee, as they advance, start to see this huge disparity between the ideal and themselves. So what we generally do as conditioned souls is we look at particular qualities and we make some effort to improve them. Maybe we buy a self-help book or sign up for some sort of a self-help course or get some sort of therapy, or we, you know, resolve to build a new habit, or, you know, something. There's so many different techniques for trying to move closer to one's ideals, and any technique that's more or less useful is adjusting one's modes of nature. You know, there's a lot of evidence, for example, that if a person just wakes up early in the morning and exercises, that they end up creating more good habits throughout their life. And I thought, well, you know, they're increasing rajagun and sattvagun. So naturally, that increase in rajagun and sattvagun is going to affect their tamagun in a general way. It's just like if you start eating sattvic food, it's going to start affecting the other parts of your life. So there are certain activities which particularly propel one up through the modes. And by propelling one up through the modes, there's a ripple effect through the rest of one's life. At the same time, Krishna says the modes are always vying for supremacy. And we see that practically. We see that if we really move up from tamagun to rajagun, we're still beset by tamagun sometimes, and even by sattvagun sometimes. And if we're able to change our, you know, our food and our habits and our associations so that we're in sattvagun, then sometimes we're just still hit by rajagun and tamagun. You know, it's just like you're bathing in the ocean, and it may be particularly calm, but still some huge wave can just come when you're not expecting it and just knock you over. And so rajagun and tamagun do this. And Krishna tells us this in the Bhagavad Gita, that the modes are always vying for supremacy, and that they're, you know, they're shifting certain times of day, certain places are under different modes. And that no living entity in this material world, Krishna says, there's no one who is not influenced by these modes of nature. So trying to get good qualities and be an ideal person by moving between the modes will always frustrate us to at least some degree. That even if we really get into sattvagun, we're not going to be fully in sattvagun. So what's the solution? The solution here is quite interesting. That it relates to Srila Prabhupada's often saying that these good qualities develop automatically by bhakti. And, you know, we kind of wonder, what does that mean? You know, they develop automatically by bhakti. And the point is that these good qualities are already there. They're not really something that needs to be developed. They're already there. They're already inherent in the soul. And the problem is not that we have to create them. The problem is we simply have to uncover them. So Prabhupada brings out the problem here is that our good qualities, our natural good qualities, the fact that we're naturally an ideal person, frankly, beyond anything that we can aspire to from a human perspective. We're part of God. We have 55 of the 64 qualities of God. So that's simply covered. It's really very much like a beautiful piece of jewelry. Sometimes the soul is compared to a diamond in a gold setting. It's simply dirty. You know, that's all. Just like you get some silver sometimes that's tarnished, it looks all discolored. And you polish it and it becomes beautiful. You know, your jewelry can become dirty and grimy and sweaty, and you take it to one of these jewelry stores and they put it in their sonic cleaner and it's just sparkling. So they haven't, the jewelry cleaner or the silver polish, it's not creating the gorgeousness of the metal or the gorgeousness of the rock. It's simply revealing it by removing that which is impeding it. You know, it's like the sun is outside and you just have to pull the curtain. When you pull the curtain, it's already there. I mean, I've also thought of it, that it's kind of our heart has a plug in it of these bad qualities. And when you pull the plug out, the natural spring of the good qualities manifest again. And so how do we remove this contamination? And this process is bhakti. But we can't remove the contamination by the modes because the modes are themselves the contamination. So the good qualities are already there. They're already there because we are a spiritual being. And we're eternally a spiritual being. Never was there a time when you did not exist, nor I, nor all these kings. Krishna says, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. Na jayate mriyate vakadachit nayam bhutva bhavitavana bhuyaha ajo nicha shasvata yam pranona hanyate hanyamane shavire. For the soul, there's never birth or death at any time. He is not come into being, does not come into being, will not come into being. He is unborn, ever-existing, primeval and eternal. He is not slain when the body is slain. Dehi nosmenyata dehe komaram yovanam jaratata dehanantara praktir jaras tatra amuyate. That we're moving through different bodies, but we're not this body. Vijayavanaya sampane brahmane gavihasani sunichai vasupakecha pandita samadarshinaha. That the sage, the pandit, the intelligent person sees that we existed before the creation of this body,
We exist through all the changes of this body, and we continue to exist after this body. And that I that exists is a spiritual being, a perfect spiritual being. I mean, the powers of the individual soul and the glories of the individual soul are inconceivable. I mean, Krishna says that. He says some hear about the soul, you know, some experience it, others cannot even understand this inconceivable soul. Right, when Gopakumar goes to the spiritual world, he says to Narada, how is it that I see you everywhere? And he says, well, I'm expanded. And Prabhupada explains this in a letter about Arjuna and Krishna, that wherever Krishna goes, Arjuna also goes, that the liberated soul can expand themselves and be in many places at once. It's just the liberated soul can be empowered by God. Just like my finger is empowered by my whole body as long as it's connected to my body and in a healthy condition. Right? I can put the whole force of my body into my hand. So the hand itself may have some limits, but I can put, by putting the weight of my body into my hand, the hand has so much more power than it has on its own. So the soul in its rightful position is basically empowered by God and can do things way beyond. I mean, we read about the mystic powers. Some of the mystic powers are one can create and destroy a universe. One can overcome the laws of material nature. But those are just material. Those are within the modes. Those are just by people who are strongly in sattva-gun. You know, flying from one planet to another without spacecraft. You wouldn't even need the Star Trek transporter machine. But that's not even spiritual. So on the spiritual level, one has far, far more power than even the mystic powers. I mean, and there's not any evil. There's not any at all. Not a tint, not a stain. Everything is completely good. So that's already there. And it's ours. It's who it's not even exactly our possessions. It's who we are. I mean, we can say that God possesses qualities and the soul possesses qualities, and at the same time, the qualities are what makes the soul and God what they are. So it's already there. It's not something that needs to be created. It's not something that needs to be developed. It's not something that needs to be, in any way done in an artificial way. It's already there. I mean, the examples given, it's a mundane example, that a healthy, normal human child has an inherent ability to walk and to speak. I've mentioned this many times, that with a newborn baby, the midwife or the doctor tests the child, and one of the tests is they hold the child up and see if it naturally puts one foot instead of another, if it tries to make a walking motion. And so that's there in the it's not just that the child sees other people walk and wants to imitate them. The tendency to walk is already inherent in the child. But other things are not inherent, like being a ballet dancer is not inherent. In fact, some of the positions of ballet, if not practiced before the age of 6, can never be practiced. Because some of the positions of ballet involve putting the hips and the legs in a position that the body doesn't naturally grow into. One has to practice it at a young age so that the bones form differently. So that being a ballet dancer and dancing around on one's toes and putting one's hips totally out to the side is not natural. That has to be done by practice. And if the skill is not kept up, then one becomes somewhat deficient in it. So this is the difference between something that's inherent and something that's artificially imposed. So all the good qualities, I mean, far, far, far beyond anything that we can imagine aspiring to as an ideal human or as an ideal son or an ideal wife or something like that. I mean, inconceivably beyond our desires to be a good person in the ordinary sense become almost laughable and absurd And it's a real shame. Actually, it's deeply a shame, and it's deeply lamentable that the majority of human beings have such low aspirations. On the one hand, the aspirations of most human beings are unattainable within the modes of nature, to be the ideal wife, the ideal son, the ideal citizen of one's country, the ideal tailor, the ideal baseball player or something, is in one hand, completely unachievable for a conditioned soul. We always fall short in some way. Or at some time, you know, you can be the world champion of something, but eventually someone else takes your place as the world champion. So on the one hand, our normal ideals of good qualities are unattainable from the material perspective because we keep being hit by waves of the lower modes that obscure those qualities. But on the other hand, even the top, or as Prabhupada likes to say, the topmost, even the summit, the peak, the ultimate possible achievement of these good qualities from a human perspective has no value and no significance compared to the actual qualities of the soul, which are already there. So just think about this irony that human beings are working very hard and being very frustrated and very disgusted with themselves at trying to achieve something that they can never fully achieve. But this thing that they want to achieve that they can never fully achieve is billions of times surpassed by what they already are. It's such an ironic and an unfortunate situation. It's something like if you already had a wonderful, varied, and delicious meal in front of you, and you were trying very hard to get some old dried-out bread that would always stay beyond your reach instead of eating the meal that is already there. So what is the problem? I mean, we don't experience these qualities of the soul. We don't even experience the human qualities, as we were saying, in their ideal form. So why is that? And that is because we have covered our natural state with something unnatural. We have voluntarily taken on something foolish. And this foolish thing we have voluntarily taken on is selfishness, self-centeredness, and wanting to put ourselves first, wanting to separate ourselves from the whole. You know, and there's one can understand this, just like the teenager wants to separate themselves from their family, and the urge to separate themselves from the family is so strong that even though there be much hardship, like in earning their own money and getting their own place and so forth, they willingly accept this hardship rather than being maintained by the parents and being subordinate to the parents. You know, one of my grandsons who's living here was just saying, I feel like I'm just being a child living in my parents' house. I said, your parents are not even here. Not like your parents are here controlling your life. It's just the house that they own. Still, I want to be a man and have my own place. And then he says, but I don't have enough money to afford it. I have to go into debt. And so it's kind of like that. We're just, I want to get away from my father's home and be my own person. I don't want the Supreme Father God to be telling me what to do. Aham bija pradapita. I want to chart my own course in life. And as soon as we think like that, then we're full of all bad qualities. And why does thinking like that fill us with bad qualities? Well, it's not so hard to understand that being self-centered means that one cannot reach any kind of an ideal, even on the human platform. Right? As soon as we're self-centered, then we're going to compromise how we treat others and what we do in life in order to try to get some benefit for ourselves. I mean, that's not rocket science. Everyone can understand that point. The other thing is that as soon as we imagine ourselves separated, you know, in one sense, bina prakriti ashrita, that this is a bina prakriti, it's a separated energy. But nothing can really be separated from Krishna. So as soon as we imagine ourselves, that's the illusion of Maya, as soon as we imagine ourselves to be separated, then we're overcome by something called fear. When I was about 6, I think, so I ran ahead of my mother to go to the playground in the park. And against her protest, and I climbed to the top of the monkey bars, and I looked around and I didn't see her. She was actually there, but I didn't see her. And I became fearful. You know, I immediately climbed down from the monkey bars and I tried to retrace my step back to home. I remember I asked a stranger to hold my hand across the busy street. So I became full of fear that I didn't have my protector. I didn't have my maintainer. I was on my own. So as soon as we imagine ourselves to be separate from Krishna, then we become full of fear. Because in a separate condition, we don't have access to the power to maintain and protect ourselves. We've lost that protection. And also, as soon as we're separate, then we have to form an identity that is separate. Our actual identity doesn't make sense anymore if we want to imagine ourselves as being separate. So instead of, you know, Jiva's, instead of that I am eternally a servant of Krishna, then we start thinking, you know, I am a creator of a universe, I am a tiger, I am a business person, and so forth. So we get all these other identities, but all these other identities, because we can't live without identity. And all these identities are temporary. Yeah, they're temporary. We're not always a businessman, we're not always a tiger. And that identity can be destroyed or hampered beyond our control very quickly and very easily. I was giving a class quite a while ago in 26 Second Avenue. And one of the guests said, is the reason that we lament the death of somebody we love is because when they're no longer there, it changes our own identity. And I realized that that was actually the case. You know, it's hard to be a good daughter if your parents have passed away. I mean, you can try to be a good daughter to their memory or what they would have liked, but you know, people will lament, oh, my mother died and I never got to do this, my husband died, I didn't get to do this, we had a fight right before he died, and so forth. I can no longer be a good wife. I mean, it's the reason that divorce is so psychologically traumatic, is it changes your identity. You can't say, I'm a married man, I'm a married woman. Your child dies, and you can't say, I'm a father, your employer goes bankrupt, you can no longer say, you know, I work for IBM. So our identity is constantly being threatened, and we're in a constant state of fear. And it is that fear that pushes us to do bad things, that is creating all of our bad qualities. It is created by this fear. We have this attachment, fear, and anger. We get attached to some identity separate from the Lord. And because of this attachment, wanting to maintain something that is false and temporary. And whenever it's threatened, if it's threatened enough, if that identity is threatened enough, we'll resort to any means in order to secure it. And that any means may include getting angry, it may include cheating and lying and so forth. If you think of when do we lie? Generally speaking, we lie to protect our sense of identity, our relationships. When do we cheat? When do we get angry? When are we harsh with others? When do we compromise lives of purity? I mean, all of these things we'll see that we do that when we feel threatened in some way. And to the degree to which we feel threatened, to that degree we have bad qualities. Therefore it's said that the materially conditioned person has no good qualities. That is because as soon as their material ego is threatened enough, they're willing to jettison those good qualities. So the degree of threat depends on the mode. So if someone's very much in the mode of ignorance, then they think everything is a threat. I'm sure we know of people who, you know, they're always assuming that they have so many enemies and everyone's out to get them. And, you know, if someone looks at them cross-eyed, then that person is their enemy. So that's very much in the mode of ignorance. So there we have that is the contamination. And this contamination makes our natural good qualities, what Prabhupada likes to say, unmanifest. They're not manifest. This attachment to our material position and our ego, our self-centeredness, our material identity causes fear, which then causes anger. To maintain this, and that anger pushes us to do things against our ideals. So how are we going to get free from this contamination? It's actually a very simple thing. I mean, philosophically, intellectually, the point is very simple. Prabhupada's saying simple for the simple. It's not a difficult philosophical idea. And that is that we again put Krishna as the center. It's actually just very simple. We put Krishna as the center, and we identify as his servant. You know, as Advaitacharya, of course, is the incarnation of Sadashiva, who is the personification of false ego. And he has this very nice verse quoted in Chaitanya Charitamrita: Chaitanya radasa moi Chaitanya radasa, Chaitanya radasa moi tanra dasa radasa. I am a servant of Lord Chaitanya, I am a servant of Lord Chaitanya, and I am a servant of his servants. That's my identity. And we practice this identity generally. The way this starts is we practice this identity by thinking of ourselves as a servant of our spiritual masters. That, you know, here's a human being, or human beings who we can see and interact with in this world, and we serve that person or persons, our guru or gurus. And a bona fide guru, of course, is also a servant of the Lord. So by serving the guru, we serve the Lord. And we gradually get in this mood that this is my identity as a servant of my spiritual master, as a servant of the Lord. And of course, that kind of identity can be mundanized if it becomes sectarian, you know. I'm a servant of Jesus and you're a servant of Allah and so I'm better than you, kind of garbage. But the principle is good. And then the guru engages us in activities of being the servant. And I've told this story many times, how in Boston Temple, probably like it was 41, 42 years ago, this woman came to the Sunday feast and she said, well, I'm already a disciple of Jesus. Jesus is my master. And I said, well, that's wonderful. I said, so suppose you hadn't told me that and I just examined your life, how would I know? She said, you wouldn't. It's all internal. So that mood is not correct. The guru engages us, Prabhupada's saying here. A person becomes fully qualified with all transcendental qualities by following the rules and regulations as recommended in different scriptures. And we have this word in the verse, mat dharmanaha, which Prabhupada translates in the word of my devotee. It can also be understood, mat dharma, mat is talking about the Lord. Dharma means religion, activities, the process. So we start to act as a servant of God. And at first we're acting as a servant of God, generally speaking. At first out of intellectual conviction, out of faith in the scriptures, out of faith in the guru. And it's an intellectual faith punctuated by times of experience. But the experience is not dominant. The theory is different. So the experiences that verify our faith, pratyaksha avagaman dharma, they come and go. Some are more sustained than others. I'm reading Vishakha's book about Srila Prabhupada, and she talks about how at certain times she would just have this experience of transcendence. Another time she would have this experience of dryness and emptiness. So these experiences may come and go, but one has intellectual faith, and based upon that, one follows the rules of the Shastra. So this is called Vaidhi Bhakti, or Vidhi Bhakti. That bhakti means love, but it's love according to some kind of rule. And we could compare this to, you know, sometimes in our human relations, the relationship becomes damaged. And someone goes to a therapist, and the therapist prescribes certain rules. I remember there was a Christian movie on relationships called Fireproof that I watched with my family. And it talked about a system developed by some Christian therapists for healing a rift within a marriage. So they wrote down a list of things to do for 40 days. You know, do something nice for your spouse without being asked. Don't say anything critical about your spouse. So it was a list of rules. And the way they show it in the film is that the husband is following these rules, I think to please his father. I saw it a long time ago. But he has a lot of resentment about it. So, you know, and his wife doesn't immediately reciprocate with him. So he's doing all these things, and she's still very cold and aloof. And he's not doing them with feeling. He's doing them ritualistically. He's doing them because they're in a book. And he told his father he would follow the book. So Vidhi Bhakti is something very much like that. We don't feel that much reciprocation from Krishna. Sometimes we do. And we have faith in our guru, and our guru tells us to do these things. So we do these things out of obedience to the guru. And then what happens is, although it's initially a kind of formula, and initially out of intellectual faith, that gradually we start putting our heart into it. So also in this movie it was like that. The father finally said to him, you know, you need to do this with your heart. You need to do this with intention. You need to do this with your motive. And so after the husband started doing that, he found that he enjoyed doing it. He enjoyed doing these rules to please his wife and heal the relationship, even if she was still cold to him. And he also found that he was willing to go over to go beyond the original 40-day program. There's a scene where she finds his book of rules, and then she says, but it's been more than 40 days. And he's like, yeah, you know, I'm committed to whatever it takes. So what happens when one follows these rules of bhakti, where Krishna is being put at the center, and particularly what's mentioned here, where one is hearing shruta about gunam, where one is hearing about the Lord's qualities, is one starts becoming attracted. As it says in the verse, he's immediately attracted. One starts becoming attracted. And once one starts becoming attracted, then things go very quickly. Prabhupada says, until nista, it's a hard struggle with determination, and after that, things happen more or less automatically. So once one, by hearing about Krishna, by chanting about Krishna, by serving Krishna, once one actually develops some real emotion of attraction, of investment, then one's contamination, which is all born out of this false identity and fear, just naturally falls away. And as it naturally falls away, one's good qualities become manifest. Now, one might raise an objection that, as I said previously, as one advances, one feels oneself very low and fallen. So it seems that the more one advances, the less one has access to one's good qualities. But the reality is that as one advances, the more one sees that one's good qualities are not really, they don't really belong to oneself in an independent sense. And the proof of that is that as soon as we imagine ourselves independent, we lose access to our native good qualities. If our native good qualities were ours independently, then our independence should increase them, not decrease them. Our native good qualities are only there when we're in relation to the whole. Just like, you know, when you pick a flower from a tree, very quickly the flower loses its scent and its beauty. Its scent and its beauty are in relationship to the tree. You know, if you cut off your finger, or even, you know, you cut your hair. So somebody has very beautiful hair, but if some hair is cut off or lying on the floor, so nobody appreciates. People, in fact, are disgusted. So I've told this story. Also, many times I was in an airport once with a whole group of devotees. And in many airports, they have some television screen showing whatever. Anyway, so on the television, there was advertisement for some hair product, and there was this young, attractive woman with outrageously beautiful hair, I mean, just thick and shiny and long and so forth, and she's kind of swinging this hair around. And I noticed that all the males in our group immediately looked at the floor. So, you know, this hair is very beautiful, but if you see some hair on the floor, if you find some hair in your food or whatever, on the sink in the bathroom, so you're disgusted. It's the same hair. So if that same woman, if she plucked out a hair and put it on the bathroom counter, you know, nobody would be attracted. So our good qualities come when we're connected with Krishna. They're there automatically, intrinsically. Yes, sorry, my internet dropped. I'm in America, but my internet dropped, so. Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me? Okay, so what do we do? What do we do is we engage in this process of hearing and chanting with the view to become attracted. We should be focusing on what attracts us to Krishna. This is, you know, we all have the same basic process, but we should really put our energy and our time into the areas of bhakti that nourish our emotional attraction to Krishna. And then we'll find that our bad qualities just start falling from us and our good qualities manifest. And you might say that, well, the great devotees are saying that they're very fallen, and that is simply because they're seeing that independent of Krishna, with the illusion of independence, they're very fallen, and that their good qualities are coming from the Lord out of His mercy and not something that they can engineer themselves. So we have questions, comments, corrections.
I've already unmuted everybody. Waiting for the good qualities, the really divine qualities to manifest, seems like it takes a really, really long time. Or maybe I'm just not doing such a great job, but it seems like I try my best and have been for 4.5+ decades. So how do we find strike the balance of waiting for the divine qualities to manifest and do, as you were giving examples, self-help and so on, to as like a crutch in the meantime to be a decent human being?
Well, I see that working separately on our good qualities with the understanding that any such separate work is doomed to an ultimate failure is something like making sure that you have nice food offerings for the Lord. You know, if you want to be a vegetarian, like Prabhupada says, if you're a devotee, you're automatically a vegetarian. But automatically doesn't mean you go to the supermarket and you close your eyes and you just pull things off the shelf and put them into your cart. You do make some effort to read the list of ingredients and in order to give a nice offering to the Lord. So in the same way, we make some effort to behave like decent human beings as part of our bhakti, But we should understand that all those efforts to behave like decent human beings that we're doing as part of our bhakti in a ritualistic or mechanical way are going to fall short. And if we're dependent on those, then yes, it will take a very long time and we will constantly fail and we'll be very discouraged. So if we consider that our efforts to improve ourselves, as is done by the materialistic people, but with the aim of pleasing Krishna, if we consider that is going to be in and of itself our process of developing good qualities, we can go on for lifetimes and we will be frustrated. The process for attaining good qualities is that the Lord becomes pleased with us. You know, and that effort to please Him by working on our good qualities pleases Him. And He allows us to be aware of the connection. It's really much more that happens. And I would hope that all of us have had experiences over the years where some long-term problem or difficulty is all of a sudden permanently eradicated by the Lord's mercy.
Nice. I have the 26 qualities in front of me.
Ah, very nice.
And the first one, I don't think it's a mistake, it's the first one. Or they're randomly ordered. The first one is he is very kind to everyone. And so, you know, the second one is he does not make anyone his enemy. The third one is he's truthful. Sixth one, he's magnanimous. Tenth, he works for everyone's benefit. 14th, he's very meek. So, you know, wouldn't it be useful to have these posted in the temples? on the wall?
I mean, the problem again, though, is as soon as I'm identifying with something other than being an eternal servant of Krishna, then anyone or anything that threatens that false identity has a high risk of inducing me to be unkind. A conditioned soul is going to be kind to other living entities only as long as their own self-interest is not threatened. So
right, but I mean, it's something like if it was on the wall.
It would help. I mean,
yeah, you would have some guidelines how you interact with other devotees. Right?
Yeah, we see this in Chaupati, that Raghunath Das Goswami, he really emphasizes the Vaishnav qualities and Vaishnav dealings between devotees. It's his, one of his primary, if not his primary emphasis in his preaching. And so you'll find that people there really, really try to have proper dealings with one another. And other places that I've gone, the authorities really emphasize sadhana in the morning program. And in those temples you find Mangal Arati is very well attended. And other places people really emphasize distributing books and Harinam. And so there's three Harinams a day, like in Soho Street Temple. There's literally three Harinam parties going on a day. And there's lots of books being distributed. And other places, they're really emphasizing prasadam. And so the temple has a restaurant and a cafe, and they distribute prasadam to universities. And so, the difficulty is that each leader tends to emphasize certain aspects of the process of bhakti yoga. And it's very difficult to emphasize all of them. That's what I see on a practical level. There's been some effort by the GBC to bring what they call devotee care more into the awareness of our devotees in general. There's a permanent devotee care committee to the GBC. One of my godbrothers, Ras Mandalu Prabhu, and his wife are working on a course about devotee care to be rolled out to the temples and so forth. So as the GBC starts to emphasize devotee care in the movement in general, hopefully it will be something that is emphasized on an individual temple basis. At least for ourselves in our own life, we can choose that we're going to emphasize how we care for others and whether or not we're kind to others. Because, I mean, like Jesus was asked, what's the most essential teachings? He said to love God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your might. And the second, which is like unto the first, is to love your neighbor as yourself. And there was, I think it was Maimonides in the Jewish tradition who actually said practically the same thing when they asked him, you know, can you give the whole Torah while standing on one leg? And he said, love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And so we have Bhakti Vinod who talks about Namruchi and Jivadora as the two main principles. And we're just about, I mean, what I'm going to be talking about, Krishna willing, next Monday, is in fact exactly this point that Lord Kapila Dev makes, that if you worship the Lord but you're not kind to other living entities, your worship becomes ineffective. So let us see if that transpires. And we actually talk about that next week if the technology holds up and I need to go to my program here. Thank you very much for allowing me to serve Srila Prabhupada and the Vaishnavas. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Goodbye.